would you be willing to break the filibuster in order to get this passed?
I'm not ready to destroy our government.
Joe Manchin, you're not ready to destroy our government? Just happy to let the Republicans do it for you?
Scared in case I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Elsewhere in California on KFOI, Red Bluff Redding, KKRN Round Mountain, KGOE Eureka. In Oregon, on KYAQ on the Central Coast, Queso and Cottage Grove, KEPW in Eugene. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on WLRI. Maui, Hawaii, KAKU. Columbus, Ohio, WGRN. Palinville, New York, WLPP. Rochester, New York, WRFZ. New Orleans, Louisiana, WHIV. Gallup, New Mexico, KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas, KPSQ. Seattle, Washington, KODX. Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR. Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, KTNF. And coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internet on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing the globe 5 days a week. Usually hosted by Brad Friedman of the Brad Blog, but they've got construction issues today. So you got me. I'm Nicole Sandler, host of The Nicole Sandler Show, based at NicoleSandler.com. And really, Brad and Desi picked a great week to tear up the concrete around their studio. I know it wasn't their doing, but Friday just reinforced my worst fears. And the bottom line is that our Capitol was attacked from within, and the Republican Party officially now stands with the attackers. Oh, we got a lot of news to get to today. Breaking news, and I wish Brad was here to do it, but I'll do my best to walk you through what transpired, and it's not pretty. Now, before I tell you how the Senate minority leader used the strongest possible language to get his caucus to filibuster a January 6th commission, let me remind you of what Mitch McConnell said the night of the insurrection while he was still Senate Majority Leader.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it. The people who stormed this building believed they were acting on the wishes and instructions of their president. And having that belief was a foreseeable consequence.
Foreseeable consequence.
Of the growing crescendo of false statements, conspiracy theories, and reckless hyperbole, which the defeated president kept shouting into the largest megaphone on planet Earth.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. Yes, those words came out of Mitch McConnell's mouth the night of the insurrection. So after they were all rushed out of the chamber because the rioters were breaking down the doors, possibly to kill them, they came back, and that's what Mitch McConnell said. He knows all of that. He knows every word that he uttered that night was true. And that's why, I guess, Mitch McConnell and the rest of the cowardly party, nothing grand about it anymore, did what they did. Because they're afraid that dear leader Donald Trump will put them out of their jobs. But really, he's not dear leader anymore. He lost, despite the gaslighting that they're trying to do to the nation. Donald Trump lost, and he lost the popular vote by over 7 million votes. His popularity is drying up because he's not on social media anymore. Yet these idiots in the Republican Party still feel compelled to bow to his every whim. Sad, really sad. But let me ask you the question. Why be a United States senator if you can't uphold your oath to protect the Constitution. America was attacked from within, and the Republican Party sided with the attackers. Now, the final vote was a disappointing 54 to 35. 60 votes were needed to overcome the filibuster. This is the first filibuster in this Congress, in case you were wondering. But 54 to 35, wait a minute, that's only 89 senators. 11 are missing. So who are the cowardly members who didn't want to cast their votes on the record? Good question. Let me tell you. Here's who didn't vote. Republicans, Blackburn of Tennessee, Blunt of Missouri, Braun of Indiana, Burr of North Carolina. Really, Burr? Wow. Inhofe of Oklahoma, Risch of Idaho, Rounds of South Dakota, Shelby of Alabama, and Toomey of Pennsylvania. Toomey is particularly disappointing because he's one of the people who actually voted for the impeachment of Donald Trump. And he's retiring. What is his problem? With 54 yes votes, they needed six more. And I don't know that there were six among that caucus, but wait a minute, we're still too shy. Also not voting, Patty Murray of Washington, a Democrat. Really? Senator Murray, what was more important than this vote today? Seriously, I want to know what was more important than this vote today. And then the last one, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Just shameful. Shockingly shameful. Now, I expect nothing better from her, but really? Wow. Arizona, you got gaslighted. Unreal. So figure, in a perfect world, Patty Murray and Kyrsten Sinema would have voted for it. So that's 56. They needed four more. Maybe they could have gotten Toomey. Maybe they could have gotten Burr. But I'm looking at the rest of the list. And yeah, they couldn't get the 10 votes. So maybe then that signals that it's time to get rid of the filibuster, which, by the way, does not exist in the Constitution. Somebody needs to sit down with Joe Manchin and teach him a bit of history because he obviously doesn't know. A reporter caught up with Joe Manchin Thursday night in the Capitol and asked him if the Republicans filibuster the creation of this January 6th commission, would that be enough to get you to get rid of the filibuster? In fact, here's the question and his answer.
Would you be willing to break the filibuster in order to get this passed? The
plan B is I'm not ready to destroy our government.
I'm not ready to destroy our government? That's what he said. I'm not ready to destroy our government. No, Senator Manchin, the Republicans did that. You're obviously not willing to save our government. And that's just about as bad. Now, I mentioned earlier that now Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell used undue influence, basically, to get his caucus to filibuster opening debate on forming this commission. Here's a report from CNN explaining what that pressure was about.
He's taking arm twisting to a whole new level is what I'm being told, John. Okay. According to two Republican sources familiar with what's going on, look, we know that Mitch McConnell has been pressuring Republican senators to vote against the January 6th commission, as you said. But we are told that in the last 24 hours that McConnell has doubled down, started reaching out to particular senators he was afraid might be wavering, and asked them to vote against the commission, quote, as a personal favor, John.
A personal
Jamie,
favor?
Jamie, it's not unprecedented. It actually happens frequently that a leader asks members of the caucus, Democrats and Republicans, I need this one. You have to take one for the team. But this is not any vote. This is not a budget vote.
Nope.
This is not, does somebody get a committee assignment? This
nope.
is about an attack on the United States government.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly right. And I'm told the senators were really caught by surprise at his using that kind of language.
Wow.
And just how insistent he's been. One Republican source said to me, quote, no one can understand why Mitch is going to this extreme of asking for a personal favor to kill the commission. The source went on to say, how can you have an attack on the Capitol and the Republican leader is saying vote against it? The source ended by saying it is despicable. And John, sources are suggesting that Mitch McConnell may really have been concerned that Mrs. Sicknick's visits today would sway some Republican senators.
Well, I can't imagine that it wouldn't. So what she's talking about there, Mrs. Sicknick is Gladys Sicknick. She is the mother of the police officer, Brian Sicknick, who was killed. Now, he was beaten and sprayed with bear spray at the riot while he was trying to protect the Capitol, protect Mitch McConnell and his members from the rioters. He died the next day. He suffered a series of strokes. Now, the medical examiner wants to say it was not caused by the riot. I would give you my typical response to that, but I can't say it on the radio. But it starts with a B and an S. Gladys Sicknick did visit as many Republican senators on Thursday as would meet with her.
Do you think you can change minds today?
I hope so. I hope so. And Brian had a work ethic like second to none. And he was just there for our country and for these guys. And he just was doing his job and he got caught up in it. And it's very sad. This is why I'm here today. Usually I'm stay in the background and I couldn't stay quiet anymore.
Yeah. Well, according to CNN, 13 Republican senators declined to meet with her. And CNN also reported that although she met with more than a dozen of the Republicans, most told her that she would not be able to change their minds. One source said to be familiar with the meetings told the network that they were, quote, very hard on Gladys Sicknick and her son's girlfriend, Sandra Garza, who were both wearing necklaces containing ashes from Brian Sicknick. The whole thing is just so distressing and unconscionable and disgusting. So they take the vote. I'm still reeling from the 11 that didn't vote. There's no excuse for that. Kyrsten Sinema and Patty Murray? I really want to know what their excuse is. And as for the Republicans who were too chicken to vote, to cast their votes on the record, every last one of them deserves to be ousted from the Senate because they don't serve the public at all. They're just worried about protecting their own butts. When the vote ended, Chuck Schumer took to the Senate floor.
The Republican minority just mounted a partisan filibuster against an independent commission to report on January 6th. Both efforts should have moved forward in a solidly bipartisan way. But out of fear or fealty to Donald Trump, the Republican minority just prevented the American people from getting the full truth about January 6th. The Republican minority just prevented the Senate from even debating the bill. No opportunity for amendments, no opportunity for debate. There was an attempt by the Republican minority to shunt this vote into the dark of night. But because of today's Senate time agreement, it was done in broad daylight. The American people will see how each Republican senator voted. Now, this should have been simple. The commission was bipartisan, independent, straight down the middle. House Democrats accepted every change that House leadership requested. Speaker Pelosi and I supported and still do support the changes Senator Collins proposed. And we told that to other senators. Senate Republicans for months publicly supported the idea of a commission. But now, all of a sudden, the Senate minority and the Senate minority leader waged a partisan filibuster against the bill. This vote has made it official. Donald Trump's big lie has now fully enveloped the Republican Party. Trump's big lie is now the defining principle of what was once the party of Lincoln. House Republicans canned Congresswoman Cheney for the crime of telling the truth that Joe Biden is president. Republican state legislatures seizing on the big lie are conducting the greatest assault on voting rights since the beginning of Jim Crow. Republicans in both chambers are trying to rewrite history and claim that January 6th was just a peaceful protest that got a little out of hand. And now this, a partisan blockade of a simple, independent, bipartisan commission. I've heard all the excuses why Republicans are opposing this bill. It's too early. It goes on too long. It's not needed. Almost all of these excuses are meritless and were invented in the past 2 weeks. We all know what's going on here. Senate Republicans chose to defend the big lie because they believe anything that might upset Donald Trump could hurt them politically. We've all lived through the horrors of January 6th. I was no further than 30 feet from those white supremacist hooligans. Do my Republican colleagues remember that day? Do my Republican colleagues remember the savage mob calling for the execution of Mike Pence? The makeshift gallows?
Yep.
Outside the Capitol?
I do.
Men with bulletproof vests and zip ties breaking into the Senate gallery and rifling through your desks. Police officers crushed between doorways. Shame on the Republican Party for trying to sweep the horrors of that day under the rug because they're afraid of Donald Trump. Our democracy has long endured because leaders of good faith, even if they disagreed, even at political cost, shared a fidelity to the truth. Not so today. I hope this is not the beginning of an effort by Senate Republicans to prevent this chamber from debating reasonable, common-sense legislation.
No, they've been at that for a long time.
After the state work period, I will bring forward legislation that would help provide equal pay for women.
Yeah,
will our Republican colleagues let the Senate debate the bill?
No.
Or will they engage in another partisan filibuster of urgent legislation?
What do you think?
We will soon see.
What do you think? We know the answer, don't we? And before we break and get on with the show, because this is obviously getting me angry, let me remind you of what some of the staunchest right-wing crazies said following the attack. All right, let's start with Mr. I Want to Be Speaker of the House himself, Kevin McCarthy. And actually, this wasn't even the night of the attack. This was a week later. A week later, Kevin McCarthy stood up on the House floor and said,
"The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility. Quell the brewing unrest and ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term."
Yeah, like that was going to happen. But Kevin McCarthy said Donald Trump bears the responsibility for inciting this riot. Donald Trump sycophant Jeanine Pirro, she was pretty adamant too.
"I want to be clear. The actions at the United States Capitol 3 days ago were deplorable, reprehensible, outright criminal.
Yeah.
These frightening and repulsive actions represent the most significant breach on our Capitol in over 200 years.
Yes.
And I don't care what happened in the past or whether those who did it think the election was stolen. That is not justification. 75 million of us are still angry about the election, but we don't storm the Capitol.
Hello.
And stop looking for other people to blame, including those dirtbag terrorists, Antifa. To those of you who did this, you did it of your own will.
Yeah.
And you will be held accountable.
No, I guess not.
Take the veil of politics off. Be totally objective. Anyone watching this must condemn it."
Yeah, well, okay, and she goes on, but I can't listen to her voice any longer. Sorry about that. But that's Judge Jeanine Pirro. Those dirtbag terrorists, Antifa. All right, we'll save that for another day because you know that's nonsense, right? Okay, let me give you one more. This man who's now once again, I guess, trying to sidle up to Donald Trump, but just days after the insurrection, this is what Chris Christie said.
"Yeah, listen, I think they're all going to have to vote their conscience and look at what happened. I mean, what we had was an incitement to riot at the United States Capitol. We had people killed. To me, there's not a whole lot of question here. So, you know.
So you think it was an impeachable offense?
Before Jordan. Oh, sure. Yeah. And
you'd vote to impeach.
I think that, you know, in the Well, that's, if I think it's an impeachable offense, that's exactly what I would do, George, but I'm not in there.
All right. So that's enough of Chris Christie. He's now changing his public tune as well. What dirt does Donald Trump have on these people? And why are they so afraid of him? Why are they letting him control their lives and render one of our two main political parties inept? Well, they already were inept, but you know what I'm saying. I should mention the six Republicans who voted in favor of advancing the bill because they deserve our appreciation, frankly, for doing the right thing. And you shouldn't have to call out someone for doing the right thing. They should just do the right thing. But in this case, we have to cite Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Bill Cassidy, Rob Portman, Lisa Murkowski, and Ben Sasse. Those are the only six Senate Republicans with any bit of integrity whatsoever. It's a sad day. It is a really sad day. And now what has to happen is Nancy Pelosi has to form her own commission to investigate what happened on January 6th. And the Republicans will scream, it's a partisan witch hunt, because they said no to an independent commission. It's amazing. And here we are. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to change gears. There's a brand new book out this week from a writer for The Atlantic, Edward Isaac Dover. And you know how every election cycle, there seems to be one book that emerges to tell the story of that campaign. Well, this time, it's Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. Edward Isaac Dover, the author of that book, joins us next. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on The Bradcast. Welcome back to The Bradcast. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today. I host The Nicole Sandler Show, based at NicoleSandler.com. And yeah, filling in for Brad and Desi. It seems that after every presidential election, one book comes out that encompasses what happened, like that makes a big splash. I'm dating myself, going back to the Clinton campaign in Primary Colors. And there have been others. And it seems that this year, looking back on the 2020 election and what preceded it, is the new book called Battle for the Soul, What Happened Inside Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. Edward Isaac Dover is our guest. Thank you so much for being here today. You're a writer for The Atlantic, and this is your first book, isn't it?
It is my first book. It's a strange experience. I'm used to writing newspaper articles or magazine articles, and this is slightly longer, but I hope entertaining throughout. And it's very kind of you to put me in that company that you were at the beginning. I should say Primary Colors, of course, was a novelization
right.
of what was happening,
that's true.
Right?
Right?
But by Joe Klein, who knew his way around things. I often felt while writing this book that this was almost like a novel unfolding, that there was so much crazy stuff that was happening, and so many interesting characters and the humanity of these folks that was coming through, and also the crisis that they were going through as Democrats and as I think all Americans were, and just figuring out what we are and what we stand for and what kind of country we're going to be. And that was really so much of it put on the line in this election. It makes me think of, there's a quote in the book from Tom Hanks, you know, the great scholar of politics, but who did a fundraiser for Joe Biden. That was virtual, and it happened during that sort of weird virtual convention that the Democrats uh-huh. were having. And on the Zoom call, he says something like, you know, when you think about all these things that are going on, all the economic crisis, public health crisis, everything, George Floyd had already happened then, that he says that all of this is happening in an election year when we actually get to make a choice. He says, you know, makes you think like maybe there's something bigger going on. But I do think like whether or not you believe in his theology of it, that all of these things happened together in the election year is really insane. And it affected what the campaigns were. But, you know, George Floyd sadly could have been killed any other year. There have been black men killed by police before and since then. The way that video was captured, the way it broke through, the pandemic obviously could have hit at any point. It happened to hit at the beginning of this and set off this everything that it did through the economy and through public health and through rethinking how things go with school and work and everything. All of that's going on. And then the crisis of democracy, you know, a lot of that is brought on by the way Donald Trump has acted about the election. But, you know, that was also a long time coming in a way. And it was all put in front of voters last year. In a way that they could decide what to do. They made a decision, pretty definitive one by the popular vote. But you think about it, Joe Biden got the most votes ever for president of the United States. Donald Trump got the second most votes for president of the United States, right? And Donald Trump, in the end, is the greatest motivator to vote in human history.
On both sides of the aisle, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so what the book tries to trace, so it's like, okay, so what was happening, right? Like I pick up this story from never before reported details of Obama and Biden watching Trump win on election.
Oh, yeah. You start there. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, I just got to say, I felt my PTSD coming back again. I start reading the book and all of a sudden I'm transported back to November 3rd, 2016. And my heart started racing. It's all around my birthday. But my heart started racing. I started getting that feeling in my stomach. It's like, oh my God, I remember this so clearly. And you take us back there, but to a scene that we hadn't been privy to before, which is both Barack Obama and Joe Biden witnessing the returns coming in. And neither one was particularly paying that much attention at the beginning to the presidential returns because they figured it was a done deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you see the process that they go through in those immediate minutes as they start to see that it's real. And then in the hours and the days afterwards. And then that picks up the story of what was going on in sort of three streams of the Democratic Party. One, the elected leaders, and not really them because they were both then out of office, but people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and what was going on with it. And more importantly, then the two other streams are these players that many of them are not household names in the Democratic Party who very quietly started to get a plan together. When nobody else, when everybody was scrambled in the Democratic Party, didn't know what to do, they start meeting. There's at the beginning of the book, there's a dinner at John Podesta's house. Podesta, who's the Clinton campaign chairman, had been a White House chief of staff for Bill Clinton. And he invites not even 10 people over for dinner, and they're sitting around the table. These people start to make a plan for what the party's going to be. But more importantly, probably, is this spontaneous reaction of activism to Trump's win among Democrats, which is more than anything brought out in the Women's March. Now, I covered the Women's March in D.C. I thought it would be like big, but I got there. I came out of Union Station from the metro and I couldn't walk for a while. Like it took a while to get to where, and I never even got to the stage that was supposed to be the center of it because there were too many people. And one of the people that I talked to for the book is Cecile Richards, who was at Planned Parenthood at the time. And she was one of those people who was not at that dinner that night, but also working behind the scenes in a lot of ways for Democrats. And she said to me, look, you know, if there had been an organization that had tried to plan the Women's March, the amount of time and money it would have taken is crazy, right? Like it never would have happened. And just happened on its own, not only in D.C., obviously, but all those women's marches all around the country.
Most definitely, the fact that it happened organically is pretty incredible. And seeing the outcome, not only here in the U.S., but around the world. I'm in South Florida, so we went down to Miami. But the thought of not going was not even a possibility. We had to show up to say, this is not okay, and we're not going to let it happen again. So
right, and that's the day after Trump's inauguration.
The inauguration,
like that, right?
Right. Now, Isaac, you mentioned the dinner. The dinner. This was after Donald Trump's victory that they regrouped to say, okay, we got to stop this. Cecile Richards, you said, wasn't there, but she was part of this planning group.
It was not like there was like a formal process, hierarchy or whatever. There were people. She is one of the better known names, probably, of that kind of person, right, who's not an elected leader, but very involved. Look, at that dinner that night, a name who has become more familiar to people, especially with what happened with her nomination by Biden, but Neera Tanden was there. Randy Weingarten, the head of the teachers union, was there. Guy Cecil, the head of the priorities super PAC, was there. Those are the type of people who, look, maybe to your listeners, they're more known names, but I think to most Americans, they're not really. But they are the people who were saying, okay, what do we do?
Right. But also in that group were Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Chris Coons, Terry McAuliffe. Right. So
that's a different.
Oh, that's
dinner,
a different
that's
dinner.
An important dinner. That dinner happens in the end of 2018.
I see.
So that happens after the Democrats have won the midterms.
Okay.
And that happens. It's like when I found out about this, and I'll tell you, Nicole, I actually haven't said this to people before. The way that I found out about that dinner is I happened to be meeting someone for a drink at the Four Seasons Hotel, which is at the edge of Georgetown, Washington. And as I'm waiting, the person was a little late. And as I'm waiting, I start to see people coming out of a room, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, others like that. And I thought, what is happening? Well, insight to how the reporting can sometimes be fortuitous, right? And it was this meeting. It was the day that Pelosi had been like formally elected speaker.
Right. So it was after the midterms when the Democrats took back the House.
So she comes in and they applaud for her. But then it's like big Democratic donors had arranged it and brought in a bunch of the big Democratic leaders. Also, Terry McAuliffe was there, the former governor of Virginia, now running again. A number of other people, Pete Buttigieg was there, Eric Swalwell was there. It was sometimes like some of them were obvious, and some of it was like, why are we here? And the meeting is just going on and on. And basically, what it was big Democratic donors who wanted the leaders to figure out how to not have a messy primary because they were worried about it. For two reasons. They didn't want to have a messy primary because they wanted to beat Trump. They also didn't want to have a messy primary because they thought that that would benefit Bernie Sanders. And they didn't want Bernie Sanders to be the nominee anyway. And they also thought he would lose to Trump. So like, that's all going on there. And like, it's really, you'd think that this is out of a movie, right? Like that there actually is a room of Democrats that sat there and plotted how to do this. And at one point someone says, well, maybe we can try to get it so that the candidates don't attack each other in the primary campaign. And Terry McAuliffe stands up and he goes, good luck with that. You know? and of course, like any primary campaign it would be like that. But there was such a worry about this. And, you know, they don't get a resolution that night about what to do. And most of the people in the meeting are like, why are we even here? And one of the people who was there, Guy Cecil, said to me afterwards, that was the last moment when the people who thought that they were in charge tried to be in charge. Because after that, you know, it's only a couple weeks after that that Elizabeth Warren announces her, I guess it was an exploratory committee, but obviously her campaign.
Sure.
And then very quickly, like she announces on New Year's Eve, and with it, by the end of January, you have a lot of other candidates, including Kamala Harris, announcing right at the end of the month.
Right. But what gets me, and I apologize, I just got the book, so I'm only a couple of chapters into it. Can't put it down.
I mean, you're enjoying it.
Well, I am. When I woke up, as I do tend to do at 2:30 in the morning, instead of turning on the TV, I read until I fell back asleep. So I'm only just beginning, but I'm reading a lot. There's obviously, you've been written about a lot. In fact, I'll get to what the New York Post did today in a moment. But first, back to this meeting. I come from a progressive place. I'm a talk show host. I'm not a journalist. You're an objective journalist. So I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. And getting this, seeing in black and white that they did it again after 2016, but they did, because we have to go later to Jim Clyburn.
Yeah.
They did it again.
Yeah.
They worked, they colluded, I'll use that word, to make sure that Bernie Sanders didn't get the nomination. Now, I got to say, in hindsight, I'm not sure that Bernie would have won in 2020. I think he would have won in 2016. In hindsight, though, I'm not sure he would have won in 2020, but that's neither here nor there. The fact is, they got together to say, what do we do about the Bernie Sanders problem? When Bernie Sanders, to my mind, is the one who motivated thousands of people to get involved. They didn't take them from other candidates. These are people who were not not involved in the electoral process at all because they thought their vote didn't count or it didn't matter or it was all fixed anyway. He got them involved. And I really think without Bernie pushing, Joe Biden perhaps wouldn't have won.
I mean, the what ifs are hard to do here because
really
there's
are
so many things that went into this. But look, I can tell you a lot of people who worked on Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2020 think he still would have won in 2020. It's hard.
He
it's
could
hard
have.
To see exactly that, right, given the voters that were turned on for Biden, what the margins were in a couple of states that could have given Trump the Electoral College. But you are absolutely right. They were not very shy about it behind closed doors of trying to stop Bernie Sanders from being the nominee. Again, I think there are two streams of this going on. One is a distaste for Bernie Sanders' politics among a lot of Democrats. And the other is a fear that he would have lost to Trump. And there's also a personal element for some of them too, people who haven't gotten over the 2016 campaign, certainly hadn't then, and who just like, no Bernie Sanders. But all those things were combining, and there was absolutely an effort among Democrats to stop him from being the nominee. And look, he came very close to being the nominee.
I know.
And I think, and one of the things that I trace in the book that you'll get to is that there was a week when it was happening, when it was almost done. the Sanders campaign screwed it up and it slipped right out of their fingers.
Was it the debate moment? Was it the debate moment when he said
the moment when he said, I only need a plurality?
Yes, that you don't need a majority. You need a plurality.
Yeah. That's plurality. Sort of the start of it. Right. And people, his friend, Larry Cohen, who runs now, that he's I think it's the chair of that group, Our Revolution.
Right. He was the Communication Workers of America.
He worked on the Sanders campaign in 16. Mm-hmm. So he's very close to Bernie. He says that's the stupidest thing Bernie ever said. But it's a couple of things that happen right then that Sanders says that sort of aggravate people who are already very worried about him being the nominee. And there is this turn against him. And I'm not sure if it hadn't been Sanders as the alternative that the Biden campaign would have revived quite in the way that it had, but it was. I mean, that's the way life goes, the way campaigns do. And then there are like specific screw ups that happen with the Sanders campaign. One of them was probably Sanders himself being really like brushing Jim Clyburn off completely over the years and not doing anything to build up that relationship. Another sort of coincidentally, essentially, that they wanted Jesse Jackson to endorse Sanders before South Carolina. And as I trace in the book, the problem was that Jesse Jackson didn't want to pick between Warren and Sanders. And with both of them still in the race, he says, I got to sit it out for right now.
Wow.
And I've got him on the plane with Ro Khanna, the congressman from California. They were both flying to South Carolina, and Khanna, who is one of Sanders' co-chairs in the campaign, is like, come on, can we get this to happen? It would really make a difference. And Jackson's like, no, I can't do it. And Jackson, of course, did endorse Sanders, but by the time he endorsed him, it was
too
basically
late.
Done.
Wow. That's the shame, because Bernie Sanders famously endorsed Jesse Jackson back when he ran.
I mean, that was when he was the mayor of Burlington and for a campaign.
Right, still.
In a different place, but yes. And you know, Sanders feels very deeply connected to Jesse Jackson and sees his own political work as a continuation of what Jackson was doing. But you know, Jackson is a political player himself,
of course,
right, obviously. And there were, this is one of many, many factors that were going to this campaign. So you look at this, it's like, it could seem, this all just happened. No, it didn't just happen. There are a lot of things going on the surface.
A lot.
And that's what I tried to trace throughout this book.
Right. But of course, for the, even more than casual observer like me, the political junkies, we saw Jim Clyburn say, hell no, Bernie Sanders is not getting this nomination. And he, for what it appeared, we know it wasn't single-handedly, but it sure looked that way, turned everything upside down on the eve of Super Tuesday, got everybody, Pete Buttigieg, to drop out before the Super Tuesday votes. It's unheard of. And
the chapter in the book about South Carolina and Super Tuesday is titled 72 Hours of Changed History.
Wow.
That's because it did.
It
right?
did.
And I was in South Carolina that week reporting on it. So remember, the schedule is that the Nevada caucuses are on a Saturday And then the following Saturday is South Carolina primary. Mm-hmm. And then 3 days later, Tuesday is Super Tuesday.
Right.
So it all happens very quickly. And that South Carolina Super Tuesday is the fastest part of it. That's the 72 hours. But you see what happens in that week of Clyburn deciding to come out. Biden had done well enough in the Nevada caucuses that he says, okay, I'm going to endorse you. He throws it in as big as he can for Biden. But even Clyburn is surprised at how big of a difference it makes for Biden, how there's this reverberating effect. For example, there was a meeting that Pete Buttigieg was supposed to have with a bunch of mayors in South Carolina. It's the mayor, whatever. It was not an endorsement event. It was just like a photo op. It would have been good for Buttigieg to have. They were willing to do it. Those mayors, after Clyburn endorsed it, you know what? We're going to cancel, right? Wow. Like it's just, it was more than the endorsement itself. It just really blew up. Simultaneously, you have some bigger pieces that were moving. I report in the book that Al Sharpton was talking to Bernie Sanders backstage, saying to him, I'm ready to endorse you. I just have to go back to my board at the National Action Network and get it to work. And then Sharpton finds out. This obviously would have been important before the South Carolina primary too, right?
Yeah.
And Sharpton finds out that Clyburn's going to endorse, and he says, "You know what? I'm not going up against Clyburn."
Oh,
and so he doesn't
God.
Do it. He never. So,
but just think, if Sharpton and Jackson had gotten on board with Bernie and went up against Clyburn, this could have changed everything, couldn't it?
It could have changed everything. I think, look, as I said, the what ifs are hard to do.
Yes.
I think what likely would have happened is that Biden still would have won South Carolina, but it would not have been probably that resounding a victory. Biden gets 50% of the vote.
Yeah.
Sanders gets a lower percentage in 2020 in South Carolina than he did in 2016. That's why it's like, oh, I guess Biden's like steamrolling here. And because Black voters, a huge part of the electorate in South Carolina and a huge part of the electorate for the Democratic Party, are what's powering Biden, that makes a big difference to him. And you know, there's a former state representative named Fletcher Smith that I talked to the night before the South Carolina primary at the end of a Biden event. And he said to me, you know, sometimes white people need Black people to tell them what, to make them see what they should do. And he's very frank about it. You know, whether or not he's right about that is a general
principle. Yeah, but it's not all Black people. Right. But it's the whole thing is still astounding. It's not like South Carolina was going to vote for the Democrat. You know, when push comes to shove in November, when it counts, those electoral college votes from South Carolina were going to go to Donald Trump.
Right.
So the fact that this turned it around is mind-blowing.
And you see in the book also that, like, the Biden campaign didn't realize what they had on their hands. He is 3 days later on Tuesday, on Super Tuesday in the afternoon, in Los Angeles, and he's at a restaurant, a chicken and waffles restaurant.
Oh,
in,
Roscoe's? I know it well. I lived in L.A. for a long time, yeah.
Right, and he's working the crowd. Of course, this is right pre-pandemic, so everybody's crowded. And he's there with Karen Bass, the congresswoman from L.A., and Eric Garcetti, the mayor. And while they're there, of course, it's Pacific time, so while they're there, Massachusetts gets called because the polls close at 7. Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren's home state, called, and it gets called for Biden. Called right away. And they're like, what is happening? And that's when they start to get the sense that this night is going to go much better for them than they expected. But they're, even as the results come in, right? Because another thing that's going on there is Mike Bloomberg's campaign. Remember that? It's a whole chapter of the book for a reason, even though most people don't
would prefer
really
to forget it.
But it played a really important role in what happened. But Bloomberg's campaign collapses very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There's this rush of support to Biden. There's a rush away from Sanders. As you point out, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke all endorse Biden the night before Super Tuesday. It's just this momentum that starts to pick up for Biden that's so fast that nobody can even make sense of it. And it's funny, it's a 500-page book. There's a lot in there, but I feel like I could have written 200 pages of it just in detailing all the different twists and turns of what happened then. It's not 200 pages there. It's maybe like 20 pages.
Right. No, but you could have. There's a movie there. There's a big story. There's a lot there. And frankly, I'm surprised, Edward Isaac DeVore, that your book, as far as I know, is really the first look at what the Democrats battled through for the 4 years to get to 2020 and to win.
Yeah.
Whether they won the soul, I don't know. although I got to tell you that here we are. Well, if we were talking 2 weeks ago, even, you would have heard me say how I've never been happier to have been so wrong, because Joe Biden is, you know, presiding over the nation as a progressive. He's doing so much of what I never thought he would do, and surprising me. Although I got to say, in the last week or two, I've used this analogy too often, so I apologize to my listeners, but it's the new administration smell is starting to wear off. Right.
Well, I would just caution you to not make any judgments, positive or negative or whatever, about what this administration is, probably for a couple more months.
Sure.
To start to see what it actually really looks like. And you may love it and you may hate it. I don't know. You'll make that decision. But look, when I talked to Biden, I did an interview with him. That was his first interview as president. We were talking. He was in the Oval Office. I was over the phone because it was still heavy COVID restrictions. Two things that you might be interested in came up in that interview. First of all, at the beginning of the interview, I said to him, and I've covered Biden for years, and that means that I have a relationship with him. I know him. He knows me. And I said to him, so, you know, this book, we played around with a couple of titles and we finally just landed. Of course, this is after the riot and everything. We're going to call it Battle for the Soul. And it felt, seeing what the book looked like in the end, that was the right title for it. And, you know, Biden has this very short, sarcastic sense of humor. And so it actually, like, warmly, but it sounded, he was being sarcastic about it. He goes, yeah, you know, the difference between you and me, pal, is I actually believe it. And I said to him, you know, actually, I think you may have been onto something with the Battle for the Soul stuff. And the other thing that that came up, though, is, you know, he said to me, he was reflecting on how people had counted him out at the beginning of the race, said things like, I personally wrote that people were saying he was out of sync with the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. There were much rougher ways that other people would talk about it. And he said to me, you know, I'm going to say something outrageous. Well, not that outrageous. I'm the most progressive person who's ever been president. And he said it like that on purpose. Okay. So that's a brushback, not just to Bernie Sanders,
but Barack Obama. Absolutely.
And his point is, and I reflect on this in writing up the interview that I did with him, is that Joe Biden is aware that his presidency is in part a function of Donald Trump, in that he was a reaction to it and it was about getting Trump out, and that primary voters were counting on him to get them. And he's aware that his presidency is in part a function of Barack Obama and being elevated to be his vice president, connection with Black voters. But he's determined to not let that be his only place in history. He wants, in that interview with me, he points out the portrait of Franklin Roosevelt he has hanging over the fireplace in the Oval Office. That's who he sees now as his North Star. And that's what he's going for.
Good. I hope he keeps that burned into his mind, because that's what we need right now. The book goes into, I know from what I've read and what I've read not in the book, a lot about Obama. I've got a million questions for you. I can't wait to read the rest of it. So, Isaac, I hope that once I'm done reading that you'll come back and we can have another conversation about it. I know you have to run for an event at the Atlantic.
I'm sorry about that.
No worries.
I'd love to come back. I hope you enjoy the book. There is a lot in there about Obama. I think what you'll see about Obama is that, contrary to what was the popular conception of him over the Trump years of being detached and not caring what's going on, you'll see there's been some attention to the language that I report him using, but what the context of that language, of how keyed in he was to what was going on, how distressed he was by it, how upset he was by it, and what it was that was really setting him off. And in a process that I think you'll see tracks with what was going on for a lot of the country and certainly for a lot of Democrats, getting more and more upset to the point that when he was campaigning for Biden into the fall, it was America is in the balance, and not the way that politicians say, like, this is the most important election ever, but for real. And that's the way Obama felt about it.
Well, it was. And there's a but there, which is the shape he left the party in. And I guess we'll end there and pick that up when we reconvene, which I can tell I'll be reading this book. So I will be back in touch. Edward Isaac Dovere. You can read him at The Atlantic, of course, but definitely check out the new book, Battle for the Soul, What Happened Inside Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. Thank you for writing this. Thank you for joining us today. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Nicole. I appreciate you having me.
Edward Isaac Dovere. I have mixed feelings about that, because I really don't want to relive that time again. But we need to remember what transpired so it doesn't repeat again. And thankfully, it's very well written, and we know all the players. My goodness, we lived through it. All right. We'll take one more quick time out and come back and stick a fork in it. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the broadcast. Welcome back to the broadcast. I'm your guest host today, Nicole Sandler, filling in for Brad and Desi while they deal with the construction noises around their studio. Hopefully, they will be back in time for the next show. Fingers crossed. So we only have a few minutes left. I figure I covered the big story of the day. Let's get on with the rest of the news. I struggled with whether or not to even cover this story, but the crazy is dangerous. So this is a warning that with reasonable Republicans going extinct, this is what we're going to be left with. And that should scare the hell out of you. Congressman who shouldn't be in Congress any longer, Matt Gaetz, appeared next to another congressman who shouldn't be in office any longer, Marjorie Taylor Greene. They appeared together at a Georgia rally Thursday night that was just sickening. Greene put on a mocking Mexican accent at one point, and Gaetz, who apparently learned nothing from the events of January 6th, spouted off about armed rebellion. Seriously, after whining about conservatives being canceled, he went on to talk about the Second Amendment.
All the fake news media, the Second Amendment is not about, it's not about hunting, it's not about recreation, it's not about sports. The Second Amendment is about maintaining within the citizenry the ability to maintain an armed rebellion against the government if that becomes necessary. I hope it never does, but it sure is important to recognize the founding principles of this nation and to make sure that they are fully understood.
It would be funny if it weren't so frightening that Matt Gaetz thinks his little gun is going to protect him from the power of the military of the United States? Right. But wait, as they say, there's more.
The internet's hall monitors out in Silicon Valley, they think they can suppress us, discourage us. Maybe if you're just a little less patriotic, maybe if you just conform to their way of thinking a little more, that you'll be allowed to participate in the digital world. Well, you know what? Silicon Valley can't cancel this movement, or this rally, or this congressman. We have a Second Amendment in this country, and I think we have an obligation to use it.
He really said that out loud, Matt Gaetz. But is he really advocating for people to take their guns to the big tech companies in Silicon Valley? Because that's what it sounds like to me, and I'm thinking the FBI needs to get involved. There's some serious crazy going on there. And really, why is this man still in Congress? Florida man, indeed. But Matt Gaetz isn't the only one of that breed making me crazy. The governor, Ron DeSantis, said Thursday that Celebrity Cruise Line's requirement that 95% of all passengers over 16 be fully vaccinated, quote, violates the spirit of an executive order he issued barring vaccine passports, as well as a state law that goes into effect July 1st. So if the cruise line, which is part of the Royal Caribbean Group, follows through, DeSantis says they'll be subject to a fine of $5,000 for each customer asked to show their vaccination status. Wow. So the standoff is hanging over Celebrity's plan for late June sailings for paying customers that will be the first in the United States after 15 months of a shutdown. The CDC requires that 95% of cruise ship passengers and 98% of crew members be fully vaccinated on non-volunteer cruises, and Celebrity said it plans to stick with those rules. Ron DeSantis, like the orange guy he idolizes, said that the rules don't apply to him. They do. Oh, I forgot to tell you about President Biden's trip to the ice cream parlor. Biden, on Thursday, was in, I forget where he was. I want to say Pennsylvania, but I could be mistaken about that. But he went to an ice cream shop. Yeah, Joe Biden got a cone, schmoozed with the crowd, you know, did his thing with his sunglasses on. And, well, after somebody asked him what flavor he got, another reporter asked him a serious question.
Chocolate chip.
Oh, yeah.
Chocolate chip. Republicans
were
prepared to block the January 6th
commission.
Eat some
chocolate
chip. Yeah, that's great. Do you see compromise and common ground on that?
Okay. On the commission? I think it's... I can't imagine anyone voting against the establishing of a commission on the greatest assault since the Civil War on the Capitol.
Okay, I can't imagine it either, but that's what happened. And it kind of makes sense when you look at who we're dealing with. I'm going to play you one last a montage of sorts put together by CNN. As Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene were speaking at their rally in Georgia, former Speaker of the House, the last Republican to have that position, Paul Ryan, was also delivering a speech. Paul Ryan, the guy who did too little, too late, is trying to be on the right side of history now. So, courtesy of our friends at CNN, here's a mashup. It's Paul Ryan, Matt Gaetz, and Marjorie Taylor Greene. And, of course, a few of their fans.
Once again, we conservatives find ourselves at a crossroads.
Taking advice on party building from Paul Ryan would be like taking advice on how to interact with your in-laws from Meghan Markle.
If the conservative cause depends on the populist appeal of one personality or of second-rate imitations, then we're not going anywhere.
This is Donald Trump's party, and I'm Trump Republican.
It was horrifying to see a presidency come to such a dishonorable and disgraceful end.
We've got to clear something up. Who won the presidential race on November 3rd for Georgia?
Voters looking for Republican leaders want to see independence in metal.
Would it not be better for Republican politicians, for Republican supporters, to move on and to look forward, even to look forward and ahead to Trump running in 2024, instead of keep on looking backward?
No, because we think this was too great of a crime, and we just can't let it go. We're not going to let it go.
They will not be impressed by the sight of yes men and flatterers flocking to Mar-a-Lago.
You know, Nazis were the National Socialist Party. Just like the Democrats are now a National Socialist Party.
You don't need me to tell
you. She did it again.
A lot of people don't like Green.
That's okay, because you know what? A lot of people didn't like Jesus Christ.
Sometimes these skirmishes are just creations of outraged peddlers, detached from reality and not worth anybody's time.
Actually, I don't know exactly what was said about the Holocaust, as to what she said. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
She compared COVID restrictions to the Holocaust.
Well, I can understand that with Mengele, the Nazi, and how he used children and people to experiment with experimental drugs.
So you're talking about the vaccine?
Yes.
Oh, man. That, my friends, is some serious crazy. And if we don't do something to change the course of this nation and take the power away from the QGP or the GQP or whatever we're calling them now, we're in big trouble. And we're out of time. So maybe we can all unplug for a little while. And hopefully when you come back, Brad and Desi will be here too. Thanks for hanging with me. I'm Nicole Sandler. Find me at NicoleSandler.com when I'm not here, guest hosting the Bradcast. I'll leave you with the immortal words of Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.